Good afternoon, everybody. This is Alan Witchie, President and CEO at the Damien Center. I'm excited to be joined today with Greg Louganis. Thank you for joining us, Greg.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, well, we are very excited to have you join us for a special event tonight, celebrating 35 years of our Damien Center existence and World AIDS Day, recognizing and celebrating those people who have come so far through this massive epidemic around the country, and those that have who are no longer with us and celebrating lives. So it's a really important day. What does World AIDS Day mean to you personally?
Well, World AIDS Day, you know, it's an opportunity in remembrance of all the people who've come and gone, because we lost so much talent and just some really incredible souls. But you know, they're remain with us in our hearts, but also celebrating that, you know, HIV/AIDS is not what it used to be. And you know, I was diagnosed HIV positive 6 months prior to the Olympic Games in 1988. And at that time, we thought of HIV/AIDS as a death sentence.
Right.
And basically, if you were diagnosed HIV positive, they say, okay, get your affairs in order because you probably have no more than 2 years to live. That was your prognosis.
Right.
And with all of the advances in treatment and care, you know, people are living regular lives. And now, you know, the services necessary for HIV/AIDS has evolved. We're, you know, looking for employment and housing, and it, you know, what the Damien Center does, I mean, they meet those needs of the HIV/AIDS community, and you know, health insurance, mental health, all of those things that go along with longevity.
Yeah, that's true. It has really evolved. It's amazing how different it was. Take me back for a minute, back to when you did find out you were HIV positive. How did you get that test back then? And how long did it take you to get results? And what was that like?
Well, in 1988, it was right when we first started back training, you know, hard training for my diving.
Yeah.
And so I was having issues with my ears, you know, had totally unrelated. And so my cousin was my doctor.
Okay.
And so I asked him, I said, you know what, just to be on, it's a big year. It's an Olympic year. It's an important year. You know, I also want to do an HIV test anonymously. And so, so I did. And then when the results came back positive, he came to where I was living and he gave me the news. And when you get news like that, you know, it's like a cancer diagnosis, right? And so, I mean, my ears were ringing. I wasn't picking up any information, what he was saying. But the one thing that because my thought was, if I was HIV positive at that time, then I was going to do the honorable thing and pack my bags. I was training in Florida, go back to California, my home, and lock myself in my house and wait to die.
Oh, wow.
Because that's what we thought of HIV
back then, right?
It was a death sentence. And so what my cousin said is that the healthiest thing would be to continue on my path, to make the Olympic team. And and then he would look after the medical side. And then my coach, Ron O'Brien, would, you know, make sure that I was in the shape to compete against the Chinese, because they had caught up to me by that time.
Right.
And so I was holding on by the skin of my teeth, you know, at that time.
But you were pretty well established in your career at that moment, right? And so tell me what you were doing leading up to this, and how you felt like your life was going, and then like how did you see it really different afterwards?
Well, it was really interesting, because I announced my retirement, you know, at 1984.
Right.
At the Olympic Games in 1984, I won my gold medals. And then I went to the nationals right after that.
Right.
So I broke Cynthia Potter's record for national titles. And so I was ready to move on. But I was also one of the athlete representatives in diving to push for trust funds to be put into place so that an athlete can continue after college, can continue their career and be able to do the commercials, endorsements, exhibitions, whatever that is. The money would go into the trust fund and they can use that money as to offset their training expenses and their living cost. And so when I went to the president of USA Diving after the Nationals in 84, he said, "Greg, you're the only one that it affects. So you're retiring. We don't have to spend, all these thousands of dollars into getting trust funds put into place." I said, "Fine. I'm not retiring. Do your homework." And so my intent was to stay eligible until the trust funds were put into place, and then I could move on with my life.
Right.
And so what happened, it took 2 years to get the trust funds put into place, and that was 86. And I was at the World Championships in Madrid, and I won. And my coach turned to me and said, "I know you said you were going to walk away after the trust funds were put into place. It's only 2 more years to the next Olympics."
Right.
And I was thinking, well, yeah, 2 years. I could do 2 years. And so that's how the 1988 Olympics happened. I wasn't supposed to be there, but because of the situations.
Right.
And then what 88 unfolded,
right.
I mean, who could be prepared for that?
Right.
It just was what it was. And you're basically dealing with the cards you're dealt.
Right. Right. And so did you think at that time, you sort of alluded to this earlier. You thought, my life's going to be shorter. It's going to be different. Obviously, it didn't go that way, which is wonderful.
Yeah.
But at the time, what did you think? Okay, what am I going to do differently now? How am I going to live my life now that, in the moment you're thinking, hey, I'm not going to be around that much longer. What changed in you? What did you do differently?
Well, it's interesting because growing up with chronic depression, I never thought I'd see my 30th birthday.
Mm.
And so then 30 came along.
Right.
And then 40 came along. And I'm like going, oh, shit, I got to get a job. It's like, what? How am I going to, keep a roof over my head? I mean, because I wasn't prepared.
Right.
And that was quite an adjustment. And I think a lot of my friends who went through diagnosed around the same time, they kind of went through the same thing. They had their affairs in order and they viaticated their life insurance policy and they did it. And then they,
lived.
And it's like, holy shit, I'm still here,
Exactly.
Because we weren't expecting.
Right.
And so it's, those adjustments. Making those adjustments and figuring out.
It's sort of like learning to live again in a way, right?
Yeah.
And finding ways that inspire you and continue to motivate you.
Right. And sometimes, and that can be challenging.
Yeah.
It can be challenging because you really have to dig deep and find out, what's important to me? What am I passionate about? I kind of resigned myself that, I'm not going to live that much longer.
Right.
And so not plan for anything. And then, but also realize how trivial most things are.
Unpack that a little bit. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, you stop sweating the small stuff.
Right.
And so then it's, and one thing that the dogs, so passionate about the dogs is they've given me that, curiosity of the joy, finding the joy in each moment and just appreciating that. And, I really get so much. I mean, they're my teachers.
Yeah. And now you're into this dog
agility
world. So tell me the dog agility. Tell me briefly what you're doing on dog agility.
Well, years ago, I had two Jack Russells and a Border Collie, mm-hmm. and I competed in dog agility, and we competed on the national stage and, in international competitions as well. And then they retired. And so then it's been 10 years and now I've got this little guy, my Hungarian Pumi G. My Hungarian Pumi G, and he has incredible talent. So my hopes and for him is to make world team. So, and what we want to do is, because he's just starting his career, because he just turned 2 years old.
Yeah.
And so we want to document that, to see, because people don't realize what goes into the training and, the diet and all that and care. It's funny because I'll make a massage appointment for my dogs and then I'll make an appointment for myself.
Can you go to the same place to get a massage for your dog and for you at the same time?
Well, actually, no, they have their own massage therapist. I have my own.
I want to take my dog and go to the same place. I'm all on board with that.
Yeah,
I think that would be fun.
But see, that's what I want to do with the dog, Joe. Is that it's a holistic treatment, wellness, and care, for humans and people, humans and canines
in the same location, essentially.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
So I love that idea.
Yeah,
I love that idea. I mean, I your dog already makes you feel better and calm.
Right.
You. And so what better, like it's almost like a multiplier, right? You're going to some place to feel better and feel calm, and you have the thing that makes you feel the most calm with you.
Yeah. I mean, we'll have dog yoga, dog meditation, and, you come with your dogs and, and also, I'm really fascinated by peak performance too.
Good.
Obviously. And so, and dog agility, peak performance, you have to take care, they're athletes.
Yeah.
So you care for them the same. And, to have this dog, Joe, that kind of holistically looks at the health and wellness, both mentally, physically, and spiritually.
I love that idea. I think it's very fun.
Yeah.
I'd love to go back just a little bit when you were talking earlier about the early years of the HIV epidemic.
Mm-hmm.
Surely you have, I know I did during that time, lost some wonderful friends and great people. Tell me about somebody or somebodies that were important to you in your life at that time, and maybe that you missed, that you lost during that time.
Well, I mean, I know it's been many, many years, and Ryan White was my buddy. I mean, I remember in 1986, the People magazine article, had Ryan White on the cover and talked about this young boy in Kokomo that was diagnosed HIV positive, contracted HIV through his clotting factor. And so he was fighting for the right to education.
Right.
And so I reached out to him.
I was going to ask you how you met him. So you kind of reached out to him after he was getting a lot of this publicity for being sort of ostracized in the school system.
Yeah, well, we were having our winter nationals at Indianapolis, and I knew he was in Indiana. I didn't know where everything logistically was, but through his mom, I reached out to his mom and asked if they could come to the nationals, because I wanted to share that with them.
Right.
And so they came to the nationals and they saw me win another national title. Right. And I took him up to the 10-meter platform and I said,
great.
This is what I do. And,
that is awesome.
And he goes, oh my God, you're crazy. he said, you're nuts, and I gave that medal to him.
Oh, that is so cool.
And so it's funny because I forgot how many medals I had given to Ryan, but Jeannie scrapbooks. And so she has scrapbooks and the medals.
Jeannie
White, Ryan's mother. Yeah. So that was really kind of special. Pan Am Games, we were here for Pan Ams. But that was, you know, just an incredible life, an incredible spirit yeah. that, you know.
And Ryan White, because a lot of people kind of know him sort of, you know, vaguely through history, but mm-hmm. we have the Children's Museum here that right. has a really nice exhibition of him.
And one of my gold medals is there.
Yes, yes. It's yeah. amazing. And then we have the Ryan White Care Act, which is funds right. people for services. But I think, like, people don't know today, what was Ryan White like? You knew him.
He was really into cars.
Yeah.
Because, like, when I first met him, he was pretty young. You know, yeah. I was around when he was getting his license yeah. and all that, and he got into cars. And, once I reached out, then all of a sudden Elton John and right. Elizabeth Taylor and all, you know, Michael Jackson and, you know, all these people, you know, started reaching out to him. And it was like a worldwide tour, you know, for him. But, he was amazing. And, I remember when he was working at a skateboard shop.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so he was really into skateboarding, which made Jeannie nuts because what? You know, he's going to fall as a hemophiliac.
Right,
and
right.
so she was really concerned about that. But, you know, the important thing is life, you right. know, living your life. And, you know, you can't be afraid of everything.
Right. Right. Did you, when he passed away, did you connect with his mother, Jeannie, afterwards, or the family at all in any way?
I can't remember what I was doing, but I remember, you know, I was unable to get there.
Right.
When he went into the hospital, I called Jeannie right. just to touch base, you know, make sure that she was okay. And who answers the phone? Elton John.
Oh, that is so wild.
And it was like, okay, you know, it's like, oh. Hi, Greg. It's Elton.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, okay. So I knew that they were in good hands.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
that somebody was there yeah. and be able to protect their privacy and just give them that dignity.
So you made a choice to kind of stand up and be an advocate during a tough time in this country when this HIV epidemic was hitting a lot of gay men, a lot of yeah. your friends, a lot of the arts community. Why? Why did you step up at that time?
You know, it was really a process for me because in 1993,
yeah.
I was cast in the play Jeffrey.
Mm-hmm. I remember that, by
yeah.
the way. I remember that you were cast in that.
I was cast in the role of Darius,
yeah.
and I was with that show for 6 months, and I played a character, Darius, who was a chorus boy with an eighth grade education, lives in a penthouse, doesn't pay rent, dumb, huh? And but he also was out in gay pride marches and proud. But I was able to face my fantasies, but also face my fears too,
right.
because he dies of complications with AIDS. And, but I felt that he delivered the most poignant message to the main character, Jeffrey,
right.
in telling Jeffrey to hate AIDS, not
right.
life.
Exactly.
And so in that process, I realized, oh my God, because I was living with this secret
right.
that I'm probably not the only one.
Right.
And so I reached out to a friend of mine, Robbie Brown, and I said, I want to write a book. And he said, oh, got the perfect person for you, Eric Marcus. And so he introduced me to Eric Marcus. And, you know, that's how Breaking the Surface came.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I knew that in my heart that, one, I wasn't the only one, but also the thought in my head was the truth shall set you free.
Right.
And so, you know, that was kind of the whole process. And I felt at the time that I was sharing my weaknesses,
right.
you know, that I was a gay man, that I was, you know, HIV positive, that I was in an abusive relationship, and all of these, you know, these things that I perceived at that time as weakness. When I was on book tour and people were coming to me asking me to sign their books and them sharing their stories, that they came to me and said, "You saved my life."
Yes.
Because absolutely. I thought I was the only one. I could relate. People were coming to me saying they came out to their friends and family about their sexuality or their HIV status through my book. And, you know, some said, "I left an abusive relationship. You gave me the courage to leave an abusive relationship." So, I mean, the impact that it had, it was not my intent.
Right.
And so my perception that I was sharing my weaknesses, by sharing my weaknesses, I learned that I was actually sharing my strength, you know, in being able to step up and be honest and be upfront and share these things that I thought were weak.
I think, like, just as a gay man at the time, even for myself, it was inspiring to hear somebody step up, because I do think you're right. There was a time period where people were debating, do I hide my HIV status? Do I hide my sexual orientation? Do I go off and try to live a private life where nobody knows, and I try to keep it as secret as possible? And you really came at that time when there really weren't these role models out there, and people were looking for that. And so young people were finally saying, "Well, I'm not going to take the, you know, abuse. I'm not willing to, you know, be suppressed by my family or be suppressed by society and suppressed by, you know, whoever." And it's, so it was, I think it was a really important message that you were getting out. And it sounds like it was even more than you had ever imagined it could be. And how has that, you know, how did that motivate you to do something more different or continue the work that you were doing?
Well, you know, it was just amazing, just and also freeing. You know, it really was, because then I didn't have to worry about who I told, who I didn't tell, what can I say in front of this person and that person. I just said whatever was on my mind, you know, so I did. And it just took away that fear, because secrets isolate you.
Right.
Secrets, you know, there's so much energy in keeping the secret, you know, but once you're able to let that secret go, then, I mean, the energy flows so much easier, you know, that you can be who you are. You can, you don't have to censor yourself. You can, you know, you can speak your mind and really be authentic.
That's great. I love that. I think that's amazing advice.
Yeah.
You've done so much in your life and in your career. What do you want your legacy to be? What do you see as something you want other people to remember you?
Yeah, I think for myself, you know, if people think of me as a diver and that's how they think of me, I hope that they think of me as being strong and graceful. As a person, and this is something that I learned from my mom, is that I made a difference.
Yeah.
And because my mother always told me, wherever you go, make everywhere you go better because you were there.
Oh, yeah.
So that's been really, you know, something, kind of a real driving force for me in trying to make everywhere I go better because I was there.
And would you say, you talked about your mother wonderfully, is that who was your, maybe your biggest inspiration, or who were your inspirations?
I you know what? Yeah. I mean, I would say that my mom was high, that she was number one.
Okay.
I would say that she was number one, because one of the things that, that I learned from my mother very early in life was everything is about the choices you make. Because I remember when I was, I think, 5 years old, and a friend of mine was having a birthday party.
Right.
But I had a rehearsal. And so she said, "Okay, you can go to the birthday party, but you're making a choice.
Right.
So if you don't show up to rehearsal, then we're not going to continue paying for your lessons.
Right.
So that's your choice. you know, if you want to go to rehearsal or if you want to go to the party.
Yeah.
But this is a choice that you are right. making. And so I chose to go to the rehearsal. I chose not to go to the birthday party. And then years later, my first Junior Olympics. It was the first time that I competed on a national level in diving. And I was not diving up to what I was capable of. And I knew it because I just felt, you know, pressure, and I was letting that get to me. You know, if they cut to 16, I was 16. If they cut to 12, I was 12. And I remember there was a break before the finals, and we went to grab a bite to eat, and I wasn't in any mood to, you know, to eat anything. So I said, I'm staying in the car. And my mother stayed with me, and she says, okay, what's going on? And I said, you know, I feel like I'm letting everybody down, and I feel I'm not diving up to my potential. And I just felt I didn't want to be there.
Right.
And she said, okay, you know, we don't have to go back to the pool. We can go home. I said, really? And so she gave me that option.
That's great.
And so that was a choice that I made to go back to the pool. But she made me promise her that mm-hmm. when I got up on the board, that I would smile. And so, you know, I think I had two more dives left.
Yeah.
And I think there were, you know, what, I was in 12th place or something like that. And I had two more dives. In those two dives, I jumped up to second place.
Wow. And it was almost like she had given you permission to choose, and that
yeah.
made let you, you know, kind of be more comfortable with the whole scenario. And
yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, that it came from me.
Yes.
That
yeah.
it wasn't imposed
right.
on me.
I love
yeah.
that. That's a great story.
Yeah.
So we're almost at the end of our time, but I want to just sort of end on, like, you've been through this whole HIV epidemic. Where do you see it going? How do you see it ending? And what does it mean if the HIV epidemic ends to you?
You know, it's interesting because, you know, in a conversation that I had with Matilda Krim, you know, she said, if we find a cure for HIV, we'll find a cure for cancer. Because I think everything's connected.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So if we do find a cure for HIV AIDS, we'll find a cure for cancer. You know, and vice versa.
Yes.
So, you know, we're all connected.
Yeah.
And I think that's the most important thing, is the realization that we are connected,
right?
And you know, in a very loving and joyful way.
Well, thank you so much for talking to me today. It's been
a
true pleasure. I've really admired all the work you've done from afar. And it's so great to meet you in person and find just what a wonderful human being you really are in person.
Thank you.
So thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you very much.
Absolutely. If anyone listening to this wants to find you, do you have any way, social media contact or places they can go to find how to get in touch with you?
Sure. They can go to gregluganis.com, my website, and on all social platforms, I'm @GregLuganis.
Okay, great. Excellent. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.